Oh, Madonna tutti.
Dan, let's talk about England while I've got you, because you're such a Premier League brain I love to pick. What is happening at Manchester United right now?
How long have you got would be my answer to that. Well, it's a combination of different factors. On the pitch, it's obvious that things aren't working. United can't score goals. They can't create chances. And when they do score goals, they ship more goals than they score, which is never a good recipe. United have got a problem, I think. I think the issue with Ten Hag is that he has a very clear idea of the football he wants. But I don't think that the message is getting through to the players. And you know, his signings have been largely questionable. I will say that aside from Lisandro Martinez, Casemiro last season and Højlund so far, you know, all the other signings have been questionable at the very least, if not.
Sofyan Amrabat, coming over from Fiorentina, who is hailed as the next big thing right at the end of the transfer window. And he came over, well, he's on loan with the obligation to buy, I think, but he's been thrown in at left back.
Well, ironically, left back is probably the position where he's played his best football this season, because he's been struggling in midfield. Premier League looks slightly too fast for him. But again, he just, you know, it's marks of a lack of a creating strategy, because you don't see the likes of City or the likes of Liverpool or the likes of Barcelona scrambling around for long signings on deadline day. United do that, and the reason why they do that is the reason that the club has never put football first for the past 15 years. Now, they may be about to change with Jim Ratcliffe completing 25%, a takeover for a 25% stake. But I think that's far too early to say. It is really, when you look at the amount of money United have spent and wasted in the past decade, how bad and how far away from where they should be they are. They've tried everything. They've tried the master tactician in Van Gaal. They've tried the serial winner in Mourinho. They've tried the club legend in Solskjaer. They've tried the, you know, transfer / geek and Rangnick, and none of them seem to work.
I think the last coach that took them to within a glimpse of the Premier League was Jose Mourinho, second place.
Yes, and he did describe that as one of his finest achievements, and he was widely mocked and ridiculed
because of what he had to work assessment. With.
Yes, and you know. The problem is that United have spent a lot of money and they've spent it very badly. But I think that, you know, it's, you know, if you go on social media and, you know, it's an easy stick to put United with, you know, people who support United can't complain about the money being spent. Because of course, United spent a fortune. But it's lack of investment in crucial areas that is... It is significant. And again, I go back to the likes of City and Liverpool. There is a proper structure in place behind the manager, behind Guardiola, behind Jurgen Klopp. There are targets that are identified long before the season is over, and that's why those groups never stand still. United, everything is reactive, everything is micromanaged, and then, you know, they've effectively allowed Eric to sign every player he wants. And that's not how a manager should be challenged uncertain on the players he wants. You know, you wouldn't, I mean, as a comparison, you wouldn't have Klopp and deciding that he wants to sign half of the Bundesliga, because he may have someone in his ear going, hang on a second, we can probably find better players at these other clubs. That doesn't happen at United, which explains why they are where they are.
Sure. And with the, how many players did they bring over from Serie A in the summer? Was it just the three? Was Onana, Højlund and Amrabat, or was there more?
Yeah. No, it was just the three.
And so is it an issue where they're just throwing money at the problem, putting a Band-Aid, you know, papering over the cracks here and hoping that they just don't show up for a period of time? Because the year before, they bought Casemiro. Exactly, so there's a lot of money being thrown around.
Oh, there is a lot of money being thrown around, but it's money that is not spent well. I mean, Højlund, time will tell, but there is obviously a player there.
Six goals in the Champions League so far, is it five or six?
Yes, he's got five in the Champions League. He's the fastest player to 5 goals in the Champions League for United. But you look at the fact that he's effectively United's only striker. He hasn't scored in the Premier League. He's missed 8 big chances so far. And he should not be in a position where an entire, you know, a team's goal scoring output depends on him. You know, Marcus Rashford has scored 1 goal in 16 or 17 games so far this season.
The Moise Kean of Manchester United.
Well, you know, he's the only striker out of 6 attacking options United have that could have scored in the Premier League this season. Casemiro is United's top scorer in all competitions this season, and he hasn't played for about a month due to a combination of injuries. And Scott McTominay has scored 3 goals. Harry Maguire has scored more than any other United forward put together if you take Rashford out of the equation. So
ouch.
That tells you everything you need to know.
Ouch. I'm not sure what to make of that, Dan. So United struggling at the moment. Where are they in the table right now in the Premier League?
Seventh,
okay. And does Edby's Brighton, whereabouts are they? They're around that sixth or eighth or something like that?
Eighth.
Yeah, so. And they don't really spend any money. They just make the cash. And it's interesting that they brought in the Sassuolo ex-coach to sort of take over from Potter, and he's been a raging success, Brighton in Europe for the first time ever. And I think it's 120-year history. Played their first home game, and I think they lost to, I think it was AEK Athens, but they have gone on to beat Ajax a couple of times. They're in contention, so De Zerbi on the verge of making history, getting Brighton out of the group there. So some good things happening for Italians also in England, or at least for former Serie A players and coaches.
With De Zerbi, I think it would be interesting once to see where he goes, to see whether he goes back to Italy, or to see whether he wants to stay in the Premier League after his spell at Brighton, because, you know, last season he was hailed as a breath of fresh air, and this season there is a feeling that he's getting a bit too outspoken, shall we say.
Too brazen.
I don't know if you...
Because he's playing, he's just changing over the team. I've done a few Brighton games this season in terms of match commentary, and he's just turning over, you know, 8 changes at a time. I know he's got Europe to deal with, but he doesn't have a very deep squad. He's bringing in players to put them on show so that they can sell them next season. So he's there for a particular purpose. But I think Brighton love him because he's making them so much money. We saw Caicedo go to Chelsea for 100 mil. Sanchez, I think it was 45.
I find it a bit rich coming from him. You know, he was complaining about the fact that he has to play every 4 days this season. I mean, this is Brighton's first European campaign, you know, ever. I don't think that moaning about having to play, you know, every 4 days is the right approach, so to speak. You know, you would expect that from someone at the bottom of maybe at the bottom, like if they were bottom of the league, I would understand. But, you know, they're 8. They are conceding a lot of goals. There is that to be said, and they are in a bit of a rut. So perhaps he needs a bit of a, you know, there's some adjusting that's needed there. But, you know, I don't think there's anything that he should be worried about.
Do you think he's saying that to take a bit of pressure off his players?
I think so. I think he's saying that because he's obviously has very high standards, and Brighton were unplayable last season. And this season they've been unplayable in spells, but they can't finish games off, and they concede so many goals. They only are the 5 teams in the Premier League have conceded more goals than they have. And I think there is an element of, you know, they've set the bar so high for themselves last season, and they've not quite reached the same heights this season. So perhaps there is an element of that. An element of frustration.
So at the same time, it takes pressure off himself as well, because a lot of pundits, including Graham Souness, would love to see him fail. So it could be seen as he's playing in Europe. He can use that excuse. He wouldn't be the first coach to use it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, he's definitely, he knows the game he's playing. And I did find his comments on the referees at the weekend quite entertaining.
What was it, 80%?
And he said that, yes, yeah, I think, you know.
80% of the referees, he doesn't like them. That's the statement more or less, isn't it? Yeah,
that's the statement. He said he doesn't like 80% of the referees. I don't think, I mean, he probably thought it would be outlandish, but I think that the majority of fans across the country probably agreed with him one way or another.
Yeah, well, look at his rise. He started off after he retired from football. I think he finished with the Trento or Romanian club. I think it was Cluj where he played, but he even played for some bigger clubs, including Napoli. Not too many games, but he did get to, well, call it the apex. He played some Serie A. But after leaving his playing days, he started off with Darfur Boario, Dan. I'm not sure where they're from, but that was back in 2013. Then he moved on to Foggia, Palermo, Benevento, Sassuolo, Shakhtar Donetsk. And I think that's where Graeme Souness got it wrong. He just assumed that he was sacked. He said, oh, he's had six jobs in the last 7 years or eight seasons. He can't be a good coach. All he did was Google Brighton to know what they're about. And he probably doesn't know the first thing. And then he's come in and blitzed everyone. More or less, he's followed on from what Potter was doing, except got Brighton playing a more attractive style of football, more like what Sassuolo were playing, because he had really good players. He had Locatelli as a pivot. He had, I don't think he had the trio of Scamacca, Berardi and Raspadori, but he would have, because I think Scamacca wasn't there yet. I think he came the year after when De Zerbi left. But he had Berardi up forward. He was the one that brought through Raspadori and got him to a very, very good level where Mancini, his attention was caught by Roberto Mancini, brought into the Italian team setup. So he is a development kind of coach. He knows, it's like he's the teenage whisperer. And I don't mean that to come across in the wrong way for some of those of you who might take it with a bit of tongue in cheek, but it's as though he knows the mentality of what it takes to get into the mind of a teenager and bring them through to that 20, 21-year-old age group and have them playing at a really high level very early on. Because he's got Ferguson there up forward, the Irish striker. And I think he's the top scorer, but he brought him in late last season and he's done so well this season. He doesn't score every game. And he's got Ansu Fati there. Ansu Fati preferred to go to Brighton because De Zerbi was there. He left Barcelona. He could have gone to a whole host of different clubs, but he chose Brighton.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredible that a player who was so, you know, highly thought of only a couple of seasons ago, obviously he's had injuries and he had a difficult spell at Barca over the last couple of years. He's done really well at Brighton since joining, and Ferguson, as you mentioned, has been a revelation so far this season. He's a throwback to a more traditional number nine, but he's so strong and so quick at the same time.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think Deserve is the kind of manager who is incredibly demanding and what wants the player to be completely committed. And I think that once the message starts getting through to young players, a lot of players probably see him as, you know, they probably realise that he can turn them into really, really good footballers, and they buy into whatever his philosophy is. On the flip side of that, you know, we often hear about how managers were so demanding, ever short shelf life at a particular club because you can only push players so much. So I think it'll be interesting to see what's in store for him at Brighton, particularly because, you know, when you look at last season, he, as I said, he set such a high bar for the club, and in terms of results, in terms of the brand of football he played, and it'll be difficult to replicate this season. But you know, there is no reason as to why they can't do it.
Exactly, and he's working with, I guess, what we would call slim pickings, but he keeps bringing these players through. Obviously, they've got an academy approach that's similar to an Atalanta or a Sassuolo, like his former club. So many talented players, and he's got high caliber players from other leagues that are willing to go and play with him. He's got some, he's recycled some fantastic players as well. He's got Adam Lallana there as well, for the ex-Liverpool attacking midfielder. He's got the former Manchester United striker, the one that scored against United. What's his name again, Dan?
Daniel Welbeck.
Daniel Welbeck. And, yeah, I mean, so he's got a squad. It's kind of like a Sampdoria feel where you recycle a few of the older names and you bring through a few new ones. Although, I guess, doesn't have the Sampdoria feel this season. They're in Serie B. But moving on from Brighton and De Zerbi, who's still doing quite well. He's in Europe. He's in Europa League. We'll see how Brighton do. Let's go to Chelsea because apparently this very week, there's some outrageous claims here that there's a little bit of embezzlement, a few dodgy dealings in terms of the economics, the finances in the Abramovich era. Do you know much about that? What's the Daily Mail saying, Dan?
Well, we haven't covered it per se. It's an investigation that's come out from The Guardian, and Chelsea may have circumvented financial fair play rules by channeling payments through offshore accounts. Now, all of these is obviously not proven as yet. And I think we should point out that Chelsea current ownership they alerted the FA and UEFA themselves to what they described as discrepancy in payments when they took over the club from Abramovich. They basically voluntarily pointed out that there were some financial figures.
Were they concerning Carlo Ancelotti and Hernan Crespo's signing and Antonio Conte? Those are the names being
thrown around. They were one of them, I believe, concerned Antonio Conte, an acquaintance of Antonio Conte.
That's right, yeah. He was an acquaintance. Yeah. You've got to have that degree of separation. Just in case. But it was an Italian acquaintance, wasn't it? And he was setting up some offshore accounts in, I'm not sure if it was the Caymans or somewhere there. And
it was, I believe, in the British Virgin Island. And it's basically, the agent, I think, is called, I believe it's called Andrea Pastorello. And according to The Guardian, he received a payment of 10 million euros from an offshore account from a company owned by Roman Abramovich the day before Chelsea announced Conte signed a new deal, which happened to be just over 9 million euros per year. Pastorello has repeatedly said, according to The Guardian, that he's not, Conte is not one of his clients, so there is no. There's no indication of any wrongdoing, but
is it about the involvement of third parties? I think that's the rule they're trying to circumvent.
Yes, basically, financial fair play rules means that you can technically anyway only spend what you make to a certain extent. You can't have a third party pouring in unlimited cash because that will skew the playing field. We could argue whether that's been enforced and how strictly that's been enforced, but I think that may be for another time.
Yeah, well, I think we could have a whole five-hour episode on that because Manchester City have about 100 claims against them. So Chelsea may end up with a points deduction, probably not this year, but it could be a future penalty coming their way. I know that we're struggling for time because you've got to move on. You've got stuff to do. But one last question. Tottenham, with Ange Postecoglou up top of the Premier League, they're not at the top anymore. They've lost a couple of games. And is this the feeling that maybe Napoli fans had last season where you sold off a couple of your best players and there's a change in terms of strategy, a new reinvigoration of sorts, a new attitude, and they're just going for it. Is this what's happening at Tottenham?
Definitely. I think nobody would have had the Spurs so high up on the table halfway through November. He's done an amazing job, Postecoglou. Again, he's someone who was perhaps ridiculed at first when he got the job because, there is a perception that winning in Scotland is something that anyone can manage, and that's It's obviously not the case. But it was amazing that Celtic has been doing really well at Spurs. And Spurs look, they look completely different. Obviously, they've lost the last few games, but as you said, there is a completely different vibe about them. They play a far more attacking, entertaining brand of football that at any point since Pochettino left 4 years ago. I guess the difference between Spurs and Napoli is the amount of teams that they have to, you know, compete with for the trophy. You know, last season in Serie A, you had, you know, Juventus were struggling, and of course you had the two Milan clubs. But Napoli were, you know, you would have expected Napoli to be in top four. Spurs have so much to contend with, because City are relentless, Liverpool are just as relentless. Arsenal have improved compared to last season. And then, of course, you've got the likes of Newcastle, who have been tested very shrewdly under Eddie Howe. Chelsea, who slowly but surely look to be a team on the up. So, you know, it's not exactly a clear-cut comparison with Napoli's last season, but there are definitely elements in there.
That'd be the closest thing to that kind of feel, because Napoli...
Yeah, well, absolutely.
In Napoli's defence, they sold off a whole bunch of players. They weren't really favourites to make the Champions League. A lot of people were umming and ahhing whether they were top four material or not. Without the inclusion of Simeone and Raspadori, who joined late in the window, people were saying, you know, they're going to be lucky even with Osimhen to finish in the top half of the table. Then they secured a couple of extra attacking signings. And then all of a sudden, things changed. They became dark horses. And then they worked their way forward in the first 7-8 rounds. They beat Milan away and they got forward. And Tottenham have done that through, I think they beat Manchester United. They got a result against Liverpool when it didn't look likely. They got a result against Arsenal. And now I definitely agree with you in terms of depth, the competitive depth up the top of the Premier League. There's a lot of cashed up clubs that are can come at you and hurt you, and they have depth because they have that cash flow, and it seems to be a never-ending river of cash, whereas Serie A clubs simply don't have it. And that's what the difference was with Napoli. They had the extra money to spend, or even though it was loans with the obligation to buy for Simeone and for Raspadori, but those two players got them over the line to win the Scudetto, because Osimhen was injured for quite a while. And with Tottenham, they lost Harry Kane, who's probably the best striker in Europe at this point. He's scored more Bundesliga goals this season in the first 12 or 13 games than what the last season's top scorer got in the whole season. So, massive loss, but it's like they play a different brand of football with Edmund. Ozzie Ange, for Australian Italians out there, Ozzie Ange coming in as the coach. And then they signed Destiny Udogie from Udinese and Guglielmo Vicario from Empoli. Those two clubs who are cellar dwellers at the bottom of Serie A, and they've come in, they've taken, I've always said Vicario was the best second best keeper in Italy after Maignan. And he's come in and he's been a revelation. So has Udogie, despite his disciplinary issues, getting sent off or getting yellow cards. What do you think of those two coming in?
I think that Vicario has a legitimate claim to be one of the best signings of the season so far. He's been tremendous. Particularly because he had big shoes to fill in, you know, with Hugo Lloris leaving the club. Lloris was, you know, been at Spurs for a long time, and it was a big figure. And Vicario has been a revelation. It has added a different dimension. Spurs, Postecoglou wants his team to play from the back, and, you know, he wants them to be progressive, and Vicario's doing that. But even in terms of his shot-stopping ability, he's been... It's been superb. He kept Spurs in the game against Chelsea 2 weeks ago when they were down to 9 men. In fact, he can probably consider himself unlucky to have conceded 4 goals in the game. And Udogie has also done really well. Spurs missed him badly at Wolves because he was obviously suspended after being sent off against Chelsea. And again, it has been interesting to see Spurs sign players that were perhaps not on the radar of other big clubs in the Premier League. That is not to say they're not good players, because they obviously are, but it is an interesting approach, you know, instead of going for the household names, going for players who are maybe slightly younger, have great potential. And that is something that Postecoglou did really well at Celtic. He tapped into the Asian market, for example, when he was a Celtic, because he has links with Japan during, you know, his spell with in the J League. So I think there is a lot to be excited about if you're a Spurs fan. Obviously, time will tell, but they're definitely doing the right thing by appointing Postecoglou, which is not something that we thought we would agree on unanimously a few months ago.
No, I mean, it was a laughingstock in the summer, people thinking Tottenham were sort of relegating themselves to being a mid-table club at best. They'd sold off Harry Kane, they got good money. Massive gloves to fill for Vicario, taking over from Lloris, and Udogie was a signing from two seasons ago. They left him to develop a little bit more at Udinese. Wonderful couple of seasons there, and now he's finally getting his chance with the Tottenham club, and he's doing really well, operating nicely with Bissouma. Decent defence, although it's a little bit hot-headed, impulsive, with Romero at the back, the former Genoa player, former Atalanta defender that went over for big money. And it was when, I think it was when Antonio Conte was there. His name keeps coming up. I think he's been to every club now. It's been kind of a dip where people thought that Tottenham were trying to keep up with the big boys, getting Conte over, getting Paratici, and trying to stay relevant. And then they've just thought, you know what, let's sell Kane. He wants to leave. He wants to win trophies. And we're going to go with Son up forward. I think they brought in Madison, who unfortunately now is injured until January. But they still had a contingency plan. And I guess a lot of that was to do around trying to replace the goalkeeper, bringing in Udogie, and seeing if Son could get his goal-scoring form of three seasons ago back.
That is exactly the way that they've been going about it. And yeah, I mean, I know a couple of Spurs fans, I'm sure you do too, and I don't think I've seen them as excited as I've seen them this season for a long time.
Yes, we have a Tottenham fan in particular that we know and love, Paul, if you're out there listening. We hope that Tottenham get back on track. I covered that Wolves game and shocking stoppage time loss 2-1 away at Wolves, and it looked so good for Tottenham to get back after that 4-1 defeat at Stamford Bridge to Chelsea, and then all of a sudden it's two losses on the trot. But there's the international break, players coming back from injury hopefully by the end of December, and we'll see how they go. In my eyes, closest thing to Napoli in terms of that underdog smell that somehow happens to be up the top. And if they're still there after 20 rounds, 22 rounds, I'll start to really, I might even get myself a Tottenham scarf, you know, just get on the tube, go up the road and get one. Dan, sports reporter for the Daily Mail, we thank you for joining us. Just one last thing. I know that you're an Italian football connoisseur of all leagues. Serie B at the moment, Parma on top. The glory days, not exactly the glory days coming back in terms of Hernan Crespo. I know that you follow Australian sport in particular, and they do have a young Australian defender, Alessandro Circati. What are your thoughts on their season overall? Just their more or less quick thoughts on their current situation in terms of where they are in the standings. And Circati, have you seen much of him, and what do you think of his development?
I think it's, his development has been brilliant. I don't think that there are many better places to develop as a young player, as a young defender in particular, than, Serie B, because the standard of football is so high, is already quite tactical. And, the fact that he's been called up to play for the Socceroos just speaks volume for how well he's matured. And, as for Parma being top of the table, you look at the table and such a competitive league, much like the Championship, really. Serie B, I think the Serie B is at times more exciting than Serie A. And, obviously, with the caveat of it being a long season, and all the rest of it, I think that Parma have as good a chance of coming back up this season as they've had since they went down. And, what a story it would be to have them back up. But as I said, it's a very long season. And even though, it feels like we've been playing for ages, it's only mid-November. And, when you think about how many games are left, there's so much that can happen, really.
Yeah, Parma on top, 29 points. Venezia trailing them by 2 points with 27 in second position. Palermo with a sniff there, 23 points. But as you said, 13 rounds in, so much football to play. Sampdoria, languishing down in 14th. That's actually quite good for them because they were in the bottom three at one stage until a couple of weeks ago. I think they've got 10 points in the last five games. So somehow Andrea Pirlo has kept his job and has helped them along. They've conceded 16 goals and scored 14. At the bottom is Frappisalo Ternana Spezia, last year's Serie A relegated sides, unluckily relegated as well against Verona in the playout, which was brought back in. Otherwise, Spezia would have stayed up. And Brescia somehow getting back into Serie B. They appealed and got their place back after some turmoil in the summer. Top scorers at the moment, Massimo Coda with Cremonese, 9 goals for him. Casiraghi, not a son of Pierluigi either. This is Sud Tirol's Daniele Casiraghi at 30 years of age, 7 goals. Parma really looking good. Went down there a couple of weeks ago, Dan. Met one of the media managers there, Fabrizio, if you're listening in. Thanks for having me. The pasta was tremendous in the cantina there, the club restaurant, and really good setup. Watched the under-19s play against Venezia, and they're moving forward. We hope to see them back in Serie A, along with, you know, good luck to all the Serie B teams. But it's such a competitive league. Nothing between a lot of the clubs, and we can see how with two or three losses or two or three wins you can get back from 13th spot up into the top eight, or it goes the other way. And that's what we saw last year, Parma losing out in the playoffs to Cagliari, who went back up. So anything can happen. It's such an erratic league and unpredictable, and we love it for that reason. We'll leave it there, Dan. Thank you for joining. Thanks for your insight. Always good to speak to you.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speak to you again.
You can find him on Twitter at Dan_Cancian. That's C-A-N-C-I-A-N. You can see all his good work there. Sports reporter that covers many different sports, including football, especially football. If you're new to Lega Football, you can follow us at Lega Football on Twitter. We're also on YouTube and on Facebook. I'm David Farini. I'm at David_Farini_. Thanks for joining, and we'll see you next time.
This is Lega Football.